Radio.
Heterosexuality and Human Identity. A presentation by Rabbi Dr. Shimon Cohen at the Christopher Dawson Center for Cultural Studies 2016 Colloquium.
Well, it's I'm also honored to be able to follow on from the very significant remarks of Archbishop Porteous last night. And I'm very gratified that, coming from a Jewish background, I see so much congruence in our perspectives on this issue, which really is an issue of universal ethics. It's a matter which concerns people of all the Abrahamic faiths, and I believe that their position will be essentially the same, because this is one which goes into the root of these great world religions and has a common root and a shared root, which has basically, to my understanding, the same perspective on this extremely important issue. Now, I'm going to permit myself also just one or two reflections before I get down to the topic proper. And this is because the little book which was launched last night was produced in haste for obvious reasons, because it's a matter of major practical significance at the moment, politically speaking. And whilst I sort of stitched it together from a number of pieces which I'd written before, and I had to put transitions in, at the same time thoughts were settling in my mind. And I think that there are, first of all, well, one thing is we have to realize that we are a rather homogeneous group, and we're all conscious, I'm sure, of the extraordinary divide on this issue. Now, really, the divide, unfortunately, comes down to the fact that we have a crisis of spiritual literacy in our society. For people here, I would put it in these terms, and it may sound surprising, it will certainly sound very surprising and strange to many people out there. Issues of sexuality, in many ways, belong in the category of those precepts which are between the human being and God. We know that there's a classic distinction between precepts between the individual and God, and between person and person. The Ten Commandments, the first five are generally between the human being and God. The second five, don't steal, don't kill, and so on and so forth, are between man and man, or person and person. Now, of course, some things like adultery, that is in the interpersonal realm, because one disturbs another person's contract, another person's relationship. But those other sexual prohibitions, such as incest, such as bestiality, and homosexuality is also one, is something which actually affects one's personal identity, because it is being placed in the category of between the human being and God. And I'll explain that. You may understand how is that so. Well, that's exactly what I'm going to speak about. And therefore, it's not something which can be waived by consent. I can, in the marketplace, in the area of collision, potential collision with my fellow human being, I could issue waivers on my property entitlements. We could contract different things. I could give up property rights. A lot could depend on mediation and consent. That's because we're dealing with something which is not intrinsic to my identity and my relationship to my Creator, the human being having been made in the image of God. I'm dealing with something external, with my property, or even maybe to a certain extent the use of my body, but not in a way which is intrinsic to my identity. And that's why, and this is something which, if that is why the whole issue is actually not to do with the question of consent. And very simply, I'm sure most people would quite intuitively acknowledge that the agreement, the consent of siblings to marry one with another, is not grounds to permit it. incest, and unfortunately, incestuous marriage exists today in Sweden. Children of one parent may marry in Sweden and have been able to do so, I think, for quite a while. It's the world leader, by the way, in this whole hedonistic materialism. But that is not a matter which is validated by consent. And I will speak about it a little more. Now, in addition to that, let me just say, too, that a fundamental theme which sort of crystallized in my mind as I was putting together that little book, and it was brought up last night, too, is that the human being is quintessentially not homosexual, even if a person has homosexual urges. Because if we follow the insight, and it's a religious insight, but it's also corroborated by a great modern psychologist called Viktor Frankl, whose book Man's Search for Meaning many of you may have encountered. The human being is a composite of body, mind, and soul. And the highest faculty in the human being is the soul, is the spirit. It's this which, as Senator Abetz said last night, quoting C.S. Lewis, it's not a body with a soul, it's a soul with a body. And it's not only with a body, it's with a mind also. And the body and the mind can be the source of all kinds of seductive impulses, suggestions, and so on and so forth. But the ultimately responsible dimension of the human being is that which is able to elevate, to levitate, so to speak, out of its mental and physical casing and take up a stance to where it is, to its own predicament. And Frankl, who was taken to the concentration camps, ultimately validated his own theory there and then. But you can't get a tougher practicum, a tougher empirical testing of such a philosophy or psychology than you would in the concentration camps. And his basic notion was that the human being is ultimately able to. Then we're speaking here about the spiritual. He called it also seeking a more neutral terminology, the conscience, if you like. That'll appeal to others who are not so religiously educated or have such a background. That this spiritual or conscience dimension of the human being is something which can always separate and distance itself from its physical, mental predicament, from its internal and external circumstances, and it is always responsible. Well, you might ask, well, what about the person who, heaven forbid, is lying in paralysis on a bed? What responsibility does that person have? Indeed. And Frankl had a very moving response to that. He says, such a person has the remaining freedom and obligation, at least, to take up an attitude towards his or her own situation. That freedom can never be removed unless, heaven forbid, a person becomes absolutely vegetative. So the essential and the highest person is that spiritual person. Now, you may say, I'm prejudicing this with the word spiritual. After all, it was also known, Frankl also referred to it as a meaning-seeking, and a meaning-identifying faculty. What right do we have to call it, to apply to it a spiritual term, the soul? Well, here, Frankl said another extraordinary thing. Frankl talked about the idea of self-transcendence. And of course, a person like Frankl, who was concerned, who believed that the human being can always take up a stance which separates him or herself from predicament, physical predicament, mental predicament, environment, and so on, an answer to it, and is also able to, it comes to this specifically through self-transcendence, transcendence of the psychophysical self, transcendence of the mind and the body. That even being in a mind and a body, being in a hellish predicament, one is able to transcend from it. And of course, how do you transcend it from this? Well, in terms which I've heard in other contexts, quite simple. We are all we are pressured by all kinds of instincts, passions, interests, and so on and so forth. One way in which we can get beyond this to true self-transcendence is not by asking what do I want, but by asking what's wanted of me. I think that's a marvelous word. That, you know, I know what I want, but what's wanted of me? And when a person moves into that situation, into that perspective, the person is actually bearing what Frankl called the unconscious God, this spiritual faculty within the human being. So that even the person who considers him or herself an atheist or an agnostic, when that person gets into this modality of discarding their personal interests, their personal feelings, their personal desires, and they begin to ask of themselves, what is asked of me? What does life require of me? Says Frankl, this is an amazing statement in my view, he says, that human being, that so-called atheist, that so-called agnostic, is actually on the same trajectory, on the same tram line, I don't know if you have trams here, which the religious person has boarded and has reached the terminus. He's on this religious person at the terminus knows that the self-transcendence is the soul. Well, the non-religious person who's commenced the process of self-transcendence has boarded the tram, which is on that route, because it is indeed that faculty, that hidden or that submerged or repressed faculty within us, which actually is an objectivity. It's the human soul. And in fact, I was absolutely blown away when I encountered in an early essay of Viktor Frankl called 10 Theses Concerning the Human, Concerning the Person, the ultimate statement in that book, which said that the ultimate discovery of the human being is the imitatio Dei, is the imitation of God. And this actually stated by a fully accredited psychologist of world stature, basically tells me, and I think tells us all, that there is a faculty within the human being, that this faculty of self-transcendence, known as the conscience, known as the soul, in fact has an objective character. It's that character which is the imitation of God, which means that we imitate God's ways in morality and in godly behaviors, which are the substance of universal ethics, in which all the great world religions ultimately agree. Okay, so that is that one. So one point, which became absolutely clear to me when I was trying to put it together, this little book, was that the essential human being is that spiritual human being, and that spiritual human being, as the soul, is not homosexual. A human being may in fact have self, as the Archbishop pointed out, have same-sex attraction, but this will be entering from sources which are essentially extraneous to the essential human being. They could be physical. Now, I'm not an expert. There have been all sorts of speculations. Does it have to do with temperament? Is there a genetic factor? Is there a temperamental factor? Is it correlated with the size of the brain, with sibling patterns and structures and so on and so forth? I personally am not afraid of acknowledging that it might be partly temperamental, because we all have temperamental features. It is said actually that even the paedophile has an orientation which is deep-seated. But the fact that a person has an orientation which is deep-seated, a person is anger, has this, has that, or whatever it is, that is not a validation. That does not provide validation of the behavior, because that is the body with which we were presented. And if a person is oriented, heaven forbid, to paedophilia or to this or to that or to I don't know to what, that itself would not ultimately sanction the behavior itself. People have impulses to kill, to steal. So what? And even if it could be documented as something to do with their juices and their physiology and their genetics, so what? The human being also has a spiritual faculty, which is answerable to temptations and inclinations and which can come from absolutely anywhere. And then you find also that there are sources of homosexuality which have psychological character. And these might be much more prevalent, where a human being is a or where a person's experienced trauma, and you know that this is very often a very bad relationship with the father, because is a cause of this, and an excessive bonding with a mother. There's lots and lots of different factors on the psychological plane. Many traumas precipitate homosexual behavior. And then there's a third level. So we've had the mental and the psychological. There's a third level, and I think this is very important. There is cultural homosexuality. You look at Greece, certain periods when liaisons of men with boys was de rigueur. It was a cultural norm. And the way in which our culture now is pushing people to experiment, to explore, and so on and so forth. Well, to use that expression which the senator quoted last night, our ordinary polymorphous perversity, the ordinary perversity of us as human beings, is enough to fuel any kind of cultural suggestion. You know, people could, if the culture is pushing it, well, the average human being is perverse enough, if they don't have a spiritual consciousness at the same time, to be driven by that too. So that there are a variety of sources, physical, psychological, and cultural, but which could produce homosexuality. But all of these are external and extraneous to the essential human being, that essential aspect, the soul, which is something which can be brought into emergence through either, well, we have had the benefit of religious education, religious experience. It's natural for us, but it can be felt perhaps also by people who don't have this background, if somehow we can begin to prompt a little bit of self-transcendence, a little bit of exposure of that native spirituality, that repressed spirituality, or that unconscious God, as Frankl called it, which is within the human being. Okay, now, I'm sorry, it's a lengthy introduction, but I want to come now quickly to the main topic, which has to do with heterosexuality and human identity. Now, I want to take this in two parts. One, I want to show how the very concept of the spiritual is linked to the idea of heterosexual procreation. And then secondly, I want to broach a topic which we began to discuss last night in the discussion following the Archbishop's paper, about how masculinity and femininity fit with the concept of the spiritual of the soul. So I suggest to amplify the discussion a little further. Well, now, I'm sure most of you know that there is a verse in Genesis which says, "Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." Well, I'm sure many of you know this, and many of you have reflected on it. What it quite simply means is, well, the parents are two, and when they reproduce and have a child, they become one. The one flesh of their offspring is the expression of their union. The union of two people become one, so to speak, through this in a very simple biological way. And that's very important, because when you think about it, that seems to bespeak a two-way relationship. First of all, the parents look at their offspring and they say, oh, that is our projection, that is our extension. We became one through this. And the child, conversely or reciprocally, says, I am the result of the union of my parents. These are my parents. Now, that could sound very, very trite, because after all, isn't it true also that animals mate and they have offspring? So what's so special about the human situation? Well, a great commentator in our tradition addresses this question and answers it very interestingly as follows. He says, the difference between the reproduction of animals, where a male and a female come together and they become one, and so to speak, they produce another, or they produce an offspring in animals, and human beings, is that with animals, once the, I mean, I'm not a zoologist or a biologist, so I may be stating this a little coarsely, that once the period of nurture is over, the young offspring goes away, and the parents go away. Except for the thoroughbred horse breeder, there's very little interest in the pedigree. Animals are not interested ultimately in who their parents were, who their children were. It's of no enduring significance. But it is of enduring significance for human beings, who their parents are, and conversely, for parents to know who their children are. In other words, lineage has a wholly different significance for human beings than it does for animals. And of course, this is something which is profoundly relevant to the whole discussion of same-sex marriage and relationships. Because we know that the offspring of a same-sex pair will not be their full biological offspring. Maybe one of them will have contributed genetic material, or maybe none. Surrogacy can complicates things even further, because there's a question of whether the surrogate mother might also in some sense be a parent. It's a very real question. After all, when you consider to compare it to grafting onto a tree, the fruit, the branch which is grafted onto a tree, is that fruit, shall we relate it back to the tree from which it previously grew, or from the tree in which it's now growing? But I won't go into all of that. But at all events, surrogacy complicates it even further. But in homosexual couples, you do not have full biological continuity. And that's a very serious matter. I'm sure many of you you've all probably thought about. But here I want to say, just this is a reflection of my own, and I'd be interested to hear your response. The very concept that the human being has a past and a future in terms of lineage, in terms of extension. Those are my parents. These are my children. I come from somewhere and I'm going somewhere. I come from my parents, I'm going further through my children. This itself has got a spiritual quality in my view. Because after all, what is it in the human being that provides continuity? Continuity between this life and the next life. I'm alive now, I will not always be alive. But there will be a continuity. The soul which inhabits my body is the soul which will depart. And if perhaps the soul has a source, an earlier source too. In other words, it is specifically the spiritual which bridges physical discreteness, difference. So that the spiritual, the soul itself, in the case of a human being, is linked to biological continuity. The soul is that which furnishes the identity of generations, not just the attachment, not just the one. And here, of course, we're not those who can't have children or adopted children. That's wonderful. They did that to help a situation. But we're talking the whole malaise with the same-sex marriage is that we are going to create orphans. To take in an orphan is wonderful. To create an orphan is not wonderful. Now, so that is one. That is number one. I put that to you for your consideration. That is one aspect in which heterosexuality is deeply linked. Of course, every human being, however they were concocted, whether through artificial donor gametes, that person has a soul. Everybody, human beings have a soul. But the point I want to make here is that the soul in its integrity and in its most harmonious and happy expression, so to speak, is a soul which knows where it came from and where it's going. Which understands I am an extension. Of course, I'm not the same as my parents, and I'm not the same as my children. I don't understand the chemistries and transmigrations of souls. That's beyond me, but I do know that in a spiritual and cultural, educational, existential sense, my children are they are my future, and my parents are my past. Whatever differences have occurred along the way. This is important. So therefore, biology and spirituality are somehow very significantly linked. And it's a great deprivation for a human being to have a rupture in lineage, whether in one's history or one's future. Now, let's go to the next question, which is, okay, that's we see how a heterosexual relationship fosters that spiritual lineage, that spirituality. Let's now look at the masculine and feminine dimensions of it. Now here, I'm going to draw on Jewish tradition and Kabbalistic tradition, and I strongly suspect this may find a resonance in other faith traditions as well. We know in our teaching, we have a notion that the creation is something which was enlivened, something from nothing. That we are absolutely dependent beings, and therefore, the creator is not dependent on anything. The whole of reality is dependent upon the creator. And is absolutely conditional and dependent on the creation. But then this was not only a one-off occurrence, fact, in the idea of the creation of the world, but it's a constant fact. There's a notion of constant creation, constant recreation. And even though, the creator in his kindness, allows all of these continuities, one minute to the next looks, it's fairly predictable and comfortable and so on and so forth. That's what nature says is a miracle which has been repeated. In other words, it's the regularities, and that's part of the Creator's kindness, that he doesn't give us too many shocks and so on and so forth. But at all events, there is a notion of creation, the creation out of nothingness, creation ex nihilo. I'm dependent constantly upon the Creator. And even though the world looks to me like something which is self-subsisting with its chains of causality and patterns and so on and so forth, that's because the Creator has willed it so, but he could also make a miraculous variation if he wanted to. And has. Now, so that is a transcendent, enlivening power. Now, if that's all there were, God would just enliven us transcendently, something from nothing, then it would be that infinity would be manifest in the creation. It would be without limits. It's a vast trend. There's nothing like such a trans. There's no analogy for this transcendent, animating power in the whole physical creation. So that is met then by a power which is, so to speak, called a contracting power, a power which is delimits this divine energy and therefore creates a whole multiplicity of objects. For example, if it's a piece of wood, it's rather insensate. There's an animal which is more lively. There's a human being which is more complex and so on and so forth. That immanently, God also, so to speak, filters this energy with another power, another limiting, contracting power, which means that every single part of creation has its own measured vitality. So it's like a filter, so to speak, on top of this infinite, if I could imagine, an infinite energy which filters and then breaks it down into parts which is suitable for everything in creation. Now, interestingly, these powers of God are metaphorically sometimes referred to as masculine and feminine powers. In other words, we see here the notion that there is that abstract transcendent power, and then there is that contracting, limiting, articulating power, this transcendence and immanence. Transcendent, God is transcendent, far beyond the creation, but also immanent within it. These two powers. Now, when we look at human reproduction, This is also the case. In other words, it's obviously not the same. There's no transcendent creation ex nihilo. It's close to the ex nihilo, but it's something from something. The man provides the seed. The woman articulates it in the course of 9 months in her womb into a whole human being. Here's the notion that the man, so to speak, was providing a transcendent possibility and foundation. The woman articulating it into a complete being. And this basic concept of masculinity and femininity is also seen in the for example, our tradition gave an ancient text. It may not always be this way. It says a man can't be clothed with a seed of flax, nor can he be nourished by a kernel of wheat. But he brings this home in sacks. So the women would take, in those days, they would take the flax, weave it into linen, and make clothing. And they would mill the wheat and make it into flour and into bread. It's something which everybody could absorb. In other words, this concept of a transcendent provider and a immanent nurturer, or a transcendent authority and a closer and a closer applier. Now, one is not greater than the other. These are both complementary forces. But we see this also in we see this also as an essential feature. And you, of course, the economic analogy will vary as times go on. But we see also in the upbringing of children that this is so. In other words, the concept of reproduction is not just a question of reproduction of a physical human being. The human being is placed on earth also is to be a moral agency of God, to render this world a fit place for God to manifest himself within. And therefore, the human being ultimately has to be a moral being. And part of the concept of propagation is the propagation of a moral generation to raise children also in such a way. And here too, the concept of masculinity and femininity play their roles. I'm not a big expert on this, but apparently one of the great crises of our time, which has to do also with family breakup, nothing to do with homosexuality necessarily, with family breakup and single parents and so on and so forth, is that boys don't have male role models. They don't have that element of moral authority. And so that's something very important. And but also the mother, so to speak, also contributes a completely different nurturing role in the moral education of children. You know, it's not always, I know that there are variations. If a child plays up, the father might have an impulse to throw the child out. The mother won't necessarily do that. The mother is the one who is there. She has a sort of a quality. She has that feeling of the specific need and condition of each member of the family. Once again, the immanent articulator of the unit. So, therefore, masculinity and femininity are great values. Whether or not there is such a thing as a male soul and a female soul, we got into this discussion. I won't go into those waters. I'm not very sure. But one thing I do know is that man and woman are two halves of one whole. In our tradition, we say they're two half souls, so to speak. They come together. Or the Archbishop spoke of it as a communion of individuals which becomes one. Together, they represent the divine. Because together they represent the transcendent, the immanent, the remoter authority and the immanent nurturer. These are powers of God himself. And not only that, they are ideally fitted in a more practical sense too. Not just for the physical propagation of a child, which again occurs in that analogy of the divine, the seed and its differentiation, but also in the moral education of a child, happy moral education of a child, where there is also, again, a differentiation of function, or can be, that the father perhaps has that more remote and abstract moral authority, which is needed, and the mother is the one who understands the variations, the differences, and the needs for a differentiated application. So therefore, in conclusion, heterosexuality is deeply connected with human identity, with the identity of the human being as one created in the image of God. It has to do with the soul, and this is something we've got to get out to the other 23 million Australians. I don't know how it's going to happen exactly. We've got to start. Biology is the vehicle for spirituality in the human being. And it is in terms of masculinity and femininity. If you're a biological male, you've been given the role by the Creator to do your best to fulfill that role as such. And if you're a female, the same thing. And by the way, also, if you're a hermaphrodite, which is an actual phenomenon, then there are rules for that too. But we're not there to transition backwards and forwards. There is a purpose in masculinity, a purpose in femininity, and the essential human being, the soul, even in the homosexual, knows that. At all events, masculinity and femininity has a deep significance, and the human soul knows the significance of the two and knows which particular function devolves upon him or her by virtue of their biological facts. Thank you very much.
That was Rabbi Dr. Shimon Cohen with Heterosexuality and Human Identity. This presentation was part of the Christopher Dawson Center for Cultural Studies 2016 colloquium on the theme, The Nature of Men and Women, Complementary but Different, which was hosted in Hobart, Australia. For more talks, interviews, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.